Welcome to episode 3 of Better Death Than Death. This is Ivan.
And this is David.
And today we are going to take a big bite out of the overall political structure. What we're going to talk about a little bit is why voting one way or another will not bring about great social change. And to illustrate a little bit, I'm going to go ahead and start with a little bit of a classic, and you can find this online. It's a text by Lenin called The State and Revolution. Go to Marxist.org and search around a little bit. You can find it. Just punch it into Google.
And they actually have a PDF for this.
Yeah, they have it in almost any format, so it's quite friendly. And one thing that I think is very relevant, a lot of people will say that a lot of these old texts aren't relevant anymore. We've moved on. It's 100 years now. The world doesn't look like that. Capitalism has changed, and there's merit to that. But there's a lot of very fundamental truths that I think people saw very early on that haven't changed. And Lenin describes how society fundamentally consists of two broad classes. You know, there's a capitalist class and there is the proletariat class. You know, the owners and the workers, if you want to make it very simple. And these classes obviously have opposing views. They have opposing needs. It's in the workers' interest to do less work with better conditions. It's in the owners' interest to have the workers do more work for less pay. That's how he makes more profit. You know, he extracts, you know, surplus value. And since these contradictions will occur, that obviously manifests itself in various struggles and strikes. You know, the worker can go on strike to secure better rights, to secure better pay. And the owner can take his production elsewhere. He can fire the worker. He can introduce illegal immigrants. He can do a number of things to help drive down wages, drive down benefits. So the state, as an institution, exists to make these two things kind of fit together. It exists to, on one hand, give some amount of arbitration, some amount of leeway, introducing basic labor rights, things like that. At the same time, it remains, of course, an instrument of capital. The state is owned by the guys who have the money and the guns, and the people with money and guns aren't the workers.
Right. Well, one thing I'd like to bring up, I think a newer concept that has come about within the last 100 years is the middle class, the golden middle class. This is kind of an intermediary realm that's accessible to the majority of the public. There was a great writer, Harry Braverman, who made an excellent statement contradicting this idea. He said, originally in the time of like Adam Smith, you know, Wealth of Nations, when those people were talking about a middle class, what they were talking about were basically the petty bourgeoisie, independent self-proprietors that were not subordinate to capital, i.e. they did not depend on capitalists to do their business. And at this point in time, we still have this concept that skilled workers, professionals, because they have a higher level of income, they are part of a middle class. However, based off the classical concepts of economics, these people are still subordinated to capital. And I think at this point in time, with the economic issues we've had within the last few years, we've seen that concept kind of come apart and collapse. Because at this point in time, based off the rapid commodification of a majority of major forms of production and retail and distribution, I mean, we don't have the mom-and-pop stores, and those were kind of like, from a classical perspective, up until even like the 60s and 70s, this was the bastion of a true middle class, of a group of people that could operate independently of capital. Nowadays, they consider the middle class to be someone who's like a doctor or a lawyer or, you know, engineer, technician of some sort that has a higher level of income. However, these people are still subordinate to capital. Therefore, their fate is in the hand of the capitalist.
I think that's an excellent point, actually. And it's a very specific element of, I would say, almost outright propaganda. The whole point is to take what is seen as the upper crust of laborers. You know, a doctor or a teacher or somebody in university doesn't consider themselves a laborer. You know, it's working class has come to very much mean like a sweaty guy in a blue dirty suit who you know, lace roads or lace down railroad track or build something. You know, nowadays that's almost entirely the purview of, you know, Mexican immigrants if you're living here in the United States. It's seen as very much that kind of work. But fundamentally, there's absolutely no difference. The doctor is working for a different person. He's getting paid for his time because he owns no property. That's the absolute definition of a proletarian. Whether he's getting paid better or worse, whether he has more or less job security, makes no difference at all to his class status. There, he is not, you know, as David said, petty bourgeoisie, because he owns nothing. He is entirely dependent on his employer, and if his employer decides that his service is no longer needed, he joins the reserve army of labor, just like the factory worker whose job got outsourced. So it's a useful distinction if you are looking to deliberately create a division in the working class. Once people realize that the guy working in the factory and the guy, you know, working in the hospital are effectively in the same class, suddenly you have a massive unity between different people that otherwise have been successfully divided. It's no different than divisions based on race or divisions based on any other cultural group.
You have people that consider themselves liberals, Democrats, and yet they look down on the working class, on people at a lower economic level, because they don't have the same level of education. They believe that these people are not economically and socially responsible. And if you don't give these people the resources or the system of education to acquire these things, then there is no incentive. And if there's a barrier of entry to these systems, then why should you expect them to be environmentally conscious? You know, how are they going to get access to a fuel efficient vehicle? And to me, that's a major failing of the Democratic Party. Initially, it was a working class movement, and it's supposed to be an egalitarian movement where everyone, I mean, they're fighting apparently for, it's for identity politics. To me, that's become a big issue. You know, they talk a lot about racism. They talk a lot about gay, lesbian rights, women's rights. But it's on a very kind of superficial surface level. It's like, well, why doesn't this person make as much money as a white male in this profession? Why don't they have the same number of people working in these positions? And to me, it seems like, you know, it's the classic concept of, you know, are you going to give a man a fish to feed him for a day, or are you going to actually teach him to fish so that they can take care of themselves for a lifetime? To me, the Democratic Party is caught in this superficial mode. They don't want to look at underlying problems, and they don't want to work with people in communities to try to improve the situation. They just want to look at numbers and, you know, produce sound bites to get people elected. That's about it.
And this is an element that is particularly insidious because, for a couple of reasons. One, and we're speaking specifically to the United States, so the situation will be slightly different depending where you live. But there is obviously an absolute dearth of true progressive movements in the country on a larger scale. We'll get to the single issue question a little bit. Obviously, everything has kind of been boiled down to the point where there's two possible poles. There's the right, and there is what is ostensibly a left. The difference between the two is that the right, and to an extent, this is the Republican Party, and to an extent, it's, you know, other what I would call radical elements that may or may not coincide with that, who are very explicitly right-wing. They have explicitly reactionary policies. They are explicitly, you know, social conservatives. They're explicitly free traders. Many of them are very rabid nationalists. Many of them are, you know, rabidly pro very specific religions, so on and so forth. You know, they are explicitly right-wing. On the flip side, the Democratic Party has not held up to kind of that counterpart, and there hasn't been any other movement that stepped up to do it. There is a plethora of very minor progressive and socialist movements that don't seem to make a splash. And part of it, I think, is, as we've talked about, identity politics. It is very easy to point out a single specific issue of oppression or of social inequality. You know, point out that, you know, racial inequality is a hot button, you know, in the United States. You can takes a question like gun control, or you can take a question like drug policies, or a question like, you know, sustainability, which is a very big kind of urban hippie word nowadays. And it's very easy to get people to back up around those things. And as long as people are following a single issue, they will not bring about any level of social change, because the capitalist system will absorb those questions. You know, women's suffrage was originally, you know, women didn't have the right to vote for a number of reasons, some of them social conservatism, and some of them simply because women being paid less than men provided, you know, a way to depress wages. There were certain jobs that men didn't do, and those were very poorly paid. When women started providing competition to traditionally male jobs, it served to drive down wages. When the rights of women and equality became kind of a liberal issue, and that became, you know, a moment people would get up and they would get in the streets and they would fight for that. And capitalism was able to accommodate that because it could move that effort elsewhere. If women are getting paid roughly equal and they're doing roughly the same kind of jobs, that's okay. We have illegal immigrants who will do it for less. We can outsource our economy and they'll do it for less. So a single issue question is always going to be eventually conceded and absorbed, and that I think helps to take a lot of the social pressure off. You know, we see what we feel is progress. You know, women are slightly better off, black people are slightly better off, you know, we have some basic labor rights, and thus we expend all this effort to get these fundamental things, and when they're granted, you know, the movement doesn't go anywhere because there's no connecting points. And I think it might be useful at this point to kind of look at some specific cases.
Well, the fundamental issue that we're dealing with is the fact that all these people have been given opportunities and freedoms, freedom of access. But it's just access. One very important thing to keep in mind is when you talk to people that are successful, they were able to build that success off a platform. They had access to resources. They had contacts, gurus, people that were able to provide them with good information and give them direction. When you go into communities that have a history of oppression, these people don't have these resources. The community itself is damaged. The infrastructure of the community is failing in a lot of cases. I mean, this is very well documented. The problem with the Democratic Party and modern leftist movements is the fact that they don't really integrate with local communities. You see that they haven't really worked directly with Hispanic or black communities. No one even talks about Native American communities. You know, they're just kind of the modern niggers of America, and, you know, we killed 5 million of them, half their population. But, you know, that's history, and it might not have even happened.
I'm guessing the reason is after we killed them all, there's not a voting base.
So, again, what you have is a lot of people making noise. You had access. However, if you want to see real change in a community, you need investment, not just in the infrastructure, but you'd also need to see banks reaching out to the black community, asking them, providing student loans, building businesses, supporting black businesses in an area. And to me, this is a very basic concept. I mean, we have a lot of highly educated people in the progressive movement. However, they're still affluent. They're still white. I mean, they've got connection. They have money. I mean, it's such a basic thing, and it's disturbing to me to see people just kind of giving lip service to these issues. As a Marxist, I mean, this is just like vulgar hypocrisy. You had the Marxists back in the 1920s writing literature about freeing black people from servitude and giving them opportunities, which is totally anathema to, you know, American concepts, where we're still talking about eugenics, for Christ's sakes. It's total madness. And I don't think the Democratic Party, that under a capitalist system, has really moved beyond that. The idea is, we've given you an opportunity, and you need to take advantage of it. And if you don't have the resources yourself, well, you're out of luck, and we're just going to ask you, why can't you do this? Why aren't you involved? Why do you still have crime? And in fact, you know, when they do say, oh, we've solved the problem, usually that's through gentrification, where you have a minority white community or affluent community move in to the minority neighborhood, and they just buy out the property. And once it's proven to other affluent individuals that a neighborhood is, quote, safe, they will also move in, start buying out the property. And again, I mean, this is not really fixing things. This is just moving an oppressed population to another area, which is, again, hypocrisy.
Right. And I think the point of access is one that probably bears repeating because it's such a fundamental thing. An interesting read, and you can find this online as well, is an old text written by a couple of people, including Bukharin, called The ABC of Communism. It's well worth a read, even if it's a little dry. One of the things he talks about is in relevance to women's rights, which, of course, we're talking about 1920s Russia. That's pretty alien concept to introduce to the population. It was an alien concept just being introduced in the West. You know, people were campaigning for the right to vote still. And one of the things he talks about, and this is such a fundamental, essential part, is whatever you do in theory is completely irrelevant if you don't take reality into account. You know, you don't need to look much further than the rights of black people in this country. After the Civil War, after the Civil Rights Movement, everybody threw up their hands and said, well, we've given everybody equal rights. We've abolished slavery. We've outlawed, you know, separate but equal. We've put an end to segregation. Now everybody's equal and it's going to be fine. But of course, that means no difference at all if the person growing up in a poor black neighborhood has no chance to go to the school that the rich and successful person will go to. It is completely irrelevant. Theoretical freedom is not freedom at all. And there's a lot more to freedom, I would argue, than merely, you know, the fundamentals. We tend to be very hung up on what's often termed negative freedoms. You know, we have the right to not be searched. We have the right to not be arrested unless we're in possession of a few grams of marijuana. Then, you know, it's totally different. But we will very rarely talk about positive rights. You know, nobody will ever fight for a constitutional amendment guaranteeing every citizen a house or guaranteeing every citizen food or education. Nobody will go to the barricades for those issues. But those are so, I would almost argue, more essential to freedom than theoretical. You know, we have the freedom of speech because we're being ignored. You know, I can say whatever I want. I'm doing it right now because, you know, the system at large won't pay attention until there's a million of us in the street. So that's a freedom we have because there's no cost to that. There's no investment, there's no human capital involved in providing fundamental freedom of speech. But we don't have a right that every citizen should have food on his table.
I think that's something that people don't really understand. And the anti-communist propaganda that's been put forth, there's this really black and white thinking about it. It's like you either have a society where you have always, Ivan put it very well, negative freedoms, where everything's open-ended. And when they look at a communist system, it's not seen as like an open, egalitarian system of sharing with your fellow human being. It's seen as a hierarchical system that controls and manages people and uses them as tools. To an extent, they did have to do that in the Soviet Union. First off, socialist and communist literature was widespread. And a big part of that idea is not only are they going to overthrow capitalism, you know, in their own community and in their own country, but, you know, everyone knew this. If this does start going, this is a worldwide movement. And so once they got that going in the Soviet Union, they knew the response in the capitalist countries would be a counter-revolution. And so what people like Stalin saw is, you know, you have to, you know, once you get groundwork laid, you have to set up defenses because they knew people were going to respond to that. And they try to stamp him out. And so he had to get very militaristic. You got to keep in mind, this, Russia was a peasant society for hundreds and hundreds of years. And it's a huge landmass. So, it was also, it was maintained by the czars for hundreds of years. And it was, so is these decentralized kind of feudal system. And of course, through communism, they're setting up a rational system of distribution of resources. And in order to do that, they had to industrialize the entire country. They had to do that so they could effectively, produce and share goods throughout the country, per the claims of Marx and the communists. They also had to industrialize in a very rapid amount of time to be able to build a modern military to protect themselves from the Germans, from the Japanese, from very militaristic countries that had been, fighting wars and that were engaged in acquisition of property and commodities through military activity. So they knew that they had no choice. They had to build a strong hierarchy that would get things done, and they would have to make sacrifices based off that. So people see that and they say, this is what communism is, and if you did institute something like this in our country, it would have to be the same thing, and that's definitely not the case.
Right. I think there's a significant difference that we would be moving from, although at the moment I think we have a very decayed industrial infrastructure, but we have those fundamental things. If you look around the world, every place that has attempted, I guess what you would call the socialist experiment, have been fundamentally oppressed backwater countries. Korea was a Japanese colony. Vietnam was a French colony. Russia was the most backwards country that was still considered part of the West. None of the places in Eastern Europe, except for East Germany, were significant places. A lot of people say that, Albania was the poorest country under communism, but they were the poorest people before. Nobody can mention the great achievements of Albania before World War II. The same case elsewhere. Hungary and some of those places were, fascist satellite states to Germany. So I think there's very fundamental differences. And when we look at it, we're in a position where we have not gone through any major war on U.S. soil. And that, we can praise ourselves lucky for that. But, there's specific reasons. It helps we have a giant ocean. It helps we have a giant navy. We have never gone through having 20 million people killed fighting the Nazis. So I think when you look at fundamental achievements, we like to pat ourselves on the back and say, oh, we won the Cold War, and now we don't really care about these people anymore because, why should we? They should manage their money better now. But I think it's a fundamental element, I think, of liberal economics, of assuming a theoretical model. It's kind of funny, because one of the fundamental criticisms leveled of Marxism is that it's too theoretical and it's not based in reality, when, in fact, I would argue it's the exact opposite. Marx was specifically analyzing, capitalist developments and, things that were unfolding during the industrialization in England, during the industrialization in Germany, and, the slow industrialization in the United States at the time. Liberal economics tends to assume a perfect state, and it doesn't factor in, concrete developments and concrete conditions in the country. We look at Cuba and we point at them because they are driving really old cars that they've lovingly maintained for 30 years because they can't import any better. But Haiti is not any better off, and they've been capitalists. Thousands of people flee from Mexico, which American companies are investing in millions of dollars a year moving jobs to Mexico. So we cry over the fact that, 100 people were shot at the Berlin Wall, but we don't care that, three times as many people die every year trying to flee from Mexico.
Not only that, but you have the drug cartel wars, which have killed more people than the entire Iraq war. Beyond that, how does this tie back into what we were initially talking about? I think these are examples of misconceptions of how a socialist and egalitarian system of running a country would work. And what we see in modern leftist movements is kind of this strange sort of liberal elitism, where they just kind of cherry pick the kind of the fashionable idea of the day. And that, you know, they give lip service to trying to help people, but they aren't really willing to compromise their own lifestyle, their own freedoms, and their own concepts. They aren't really willing to put in the work, concrete efforts to make a real change in the world. At least not at the mainstream level, not at the policy, the national policy producing level. I mean, we do have what the right considers is Obamacare, which they consider a socialist movement in itself. If you look at the hierarchy of the way that system is set up, I mean, it's very capitalist. I mean, everyone is still paying into a system. It's based off economic tiers that they're trying to make more equitable. The fundamental problem with the medical industry is we expect to have a certain quality of life, and I think that's a fair expectation. I mean, we all work very hard, and people have worked hard for 100 years to develop the industrial and technological revolution, so I think everyone should be able to expect to live a good 75 years relatively illness-free compared to populations did 100 years ago. The problem we face under a capitalist system is all this is commodified, and therefore profit is derived from basic human services that we all expect to be able to use as part of quality of life in the modern world. And I think there's a big contradiction between providing human services and then the profit motives, which actually drive the medical industry at this point in time.
And this is one of those things where when you listen to the arguments against, you know, something as simple as, you know, universal health care, which pretty much globally has been declared to be, you know, a fundamental human right, you know. If you get sick, you have the right to be treated without being bankrupt in the process. I remember, and I don't remember which of the conservative commentators was, one of the talking heads on talk radio, it might have been Glenn Beck or whoever, they're all fairly interchangeable, declaring loudly and aggressively when the Obamacare was first being discussed that medical care, you know, was not a right. And that is such a fundamentally unhuman proposition to begin with. The idea is that it is, as every other instance of our lives and our civilization has been commodified, medical care is exactly the same.
So at this point, we would like to wind things down. We'd like to thank you for taking the time to listen to Better Red Than Dead. My name is David.
My name is Ivan. And we will talk to you again in a couple of weeks with the next topic. Thank you so much. Bye.